Shalom, Hadavarnix. Well, we're ready to start our next session on the First Regathering Modern Israel. We will be in session 40 this time, and session 40 can be found on page 342 of your notebook, 342. So let's do our review, recall where we've been. Last session, we saw that Israel and the United States suffered a tragedy when astronaut Ilan Ramon was lost with the rest of the crew in the space shuttle disaster. Mahmoud Abbas was elected as the prime minister or president of the Palestinian Authority. He's the man who transferred millions of Palestinian Authority money to European banks through his brother. So we have a corruption-free government in the Palestinian Authority through him. Ahmed Kouria Mahmoud Abbas soon resigned, and Ahmed Kouria took his place for a short time. Israel then assassinated Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, one of the co-founders of Hamas, and a man directly responsible for many, many Israeli deaths and terrorist attacks. He was succeeded by Abdul Aziz Rantisi, and Abdul Aziz Rantisi didn't last very long either. Israel assassinated him. Again, he is one of the co-founders of Hamas, along with Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. The next leader of Hamas was not publicly announced because they were afraid Israel would then assassinate him. Ariel Sharon decided to do a unilateral withdrawal from the Palestinians, starting with the Gaza Strip and some settlements in the northern part of the West Bank. And in the Gaza Strip, the Gush Katif area, Kfar Darom, Netzarim, and Nisanit are the four areas where the vast majority of the settlers were living, and they would all be evacuated. And it was a heartrending time for the Israelis, as Israeli soldiers were required to evict Israeli citizens from their homes. Very tough. Ariel Sharon felt he had no other choice but to do this, but it was very, very tough on the nation. All right, that brings us now to page 342, and we begin with the Gaza handover. Now, last week I mentioned to you the reasons why I wanted to look into this article that I wrote in a little bit of depth. I felt that the two governments, Israel and the United States, were being criticized for this philosophy of giving up land for peace. And I felt that these accusations were unwarranted because they ignored pertinent biblical and historical facts. So I want to go through briefly some of those historical facts, because I believe if you have a more rounded view, I should say, I want to go through those biblical facts, because if you have a more rounded view of the Bible, I think you'll have a more objective view of what's going on, especially with the Gaza handover. So you can read most of that article on your own. We'll just hit on a few of the highlights here. So let's start with point A. Point A, we must remember that possession of the land is contingent on obedience to the Mosaic Covenant and the Land Covenant. The blessing of possession of the land, actually occupying the land, is contingent on obedience. Secondly, point B, we, the Jewish people, are currently not obedient to the Mosaic Covenant and the Land Covenant. Page 343. C. Now the Jewish people are promised the entire western arm of the Fertile Crescent, from the Euphrates River to the River of Egypt, and from the eastern wilderness to the Mediterranean Sea. And I want you to see the map on page 343. Refer to the map on page 343. Here's a copy of it. This is the boundaries of the land during the Messianic Kingdom, the boundaries of the land, as I understand them, that have been given to the Jewish people. Now notice, neither the wilderness of Sinai, down there in the left bottom corner, or the Arabian Peninsula in the right bottom corner, are part of the Promised Land. Many people think they are included in the Promised Land, but it's a study of Scripture shows that they cannot be. So that's the boundaries of the land that's going to be inherited by the Jewish people. That's been promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, D is an important point. We, the Jewish people, have never possessed all the Promised Land, and we do not do so today. Please note that the modern state of Israel only comprises a small portion of the entire Promised Land. Here's our map again. The boundaries during the Messianic Kingdom, and here, this is the boundaries of the modern state of Israel, down in the southern end of the Promised Land. So that makes up maybe 30% of the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, that's it right there. Now, a graph diagramming Jewish possession of the land, if you graph it out, you will clearly see that the land goes through constant expansion and contraction of territory depending on our obedience over time. Now, the next sentence is a mark it up moment. Mark this. We will not possess 100% of the Promised Land until the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. The next sentence is important too. The Gaza handover is simply an experience of contraction like those that have occurred in the past. This is nothing new. Now, you can refer to your chart, the graph entitled Possession of the Land, following point F on page 344. I'm going to reproduce that chart on the PowerPoint, although it will look a little different. It will look a little different to you. So we'll start with reviewing the ancient possession of the land. Now here's our chart. To begin with, when Abraham entered the land, he possessed very, very little of the land. In fact, he had to buy his own burial cave. So very, very little of the land was possessed at the beginning. But when we entered the land during the book of Judges, after the Egyptian bondage, we began to gain the land back. So we've gained maybe 20% of the land during the time of the Judges. Under the United Kingdom, the possession of the land expanded to its greatest extent. Jewish occupation of the land expanded to its greatest percent, say approximately 70% of the Promised Land. And here's a map. It's entitled Solomon's Kingdom, Jewish possession of the land to its greatest extent to date, or Jewish occupation of the land to its greatest extent to date. It goes all the way from the Wadi al-Arish all the way up to the Euphrates River. But there are still large swaths of land that have not been possessed and occupied. Now, just to note, here in the red circle is King Saul's kingdom. King Saul was not particularly obedient, so his possession, his occupation of the land, only covered this much area, the pink area. Now, David, however, was a very obedient king, a man after God's own heart. So God blessed David's rule, and his control, his territory, expanded to this much, to this area in the red circle. Well, Solomon's kingdom got started off on a good foot, and Solomon's economic control expanded all the way to the Euphrates River. So that area to the north in the yellow is really economic control, not really possession and occupation of the land. But then Solomon's kingdom fell apart. His disobedience was lacking, and the kingdom began to contract. But this is the greatest extent to date. Notice that Hamat and Phoenicia and Gaza are not possessed and occupied by the Jewish people. So we didn't occupy all the Promised Land, even under Solomon's kingdom. That's the greatest possession and occupation to date. Well, the kingdom divided over the issue of taxes, and our enemies began to harass us because we were not true to the Lord, the northern kingdom especially, and so we began to lose land. the occupation and possession of land began to contract. With the Assyrian conquest, we lost quite a bit of land, as the northern kingdom was now dominated by Assyria. Well, then the Babylonians came in and exiled the southern kingdom out of the land, and so now we're down to very, very little possession of land. A small remnant of people, of Jewish people, lived in the land during the Babylonian exile, but for all intents and purposes, we didn't possess any of it. It was under the control of Babylon. However, after 70 years, we returned to our land and began to the possession and occupation of the land began to increase. Under the Hellenistic period, our occupation of land increased to maybe 40% of what was promised to us. But then the Romans came in and we lost territory again. Our possession and occupation contracted as Rome dominated the area. And then the first worldwide dispersion came, beginning in 70 AD, finished up by 135 AD, and again we were out of the land. Our possession and occupation of the land was down to practically zero. Again, a small remnant lived in the land, but that's all. Now, let's take a look at the modern possession of the land. We're going to begin with the first worldwide dispersion caused by the Romans. 2,000 years, the vast majority of the Jewish population was scattered all over the world. Then came the first worldwide regathering, 1839 to 1948, the subject of the first part of our class, the modern Zionist movement and the creation of the State of Israel. We began to buy back land, and so our possession and occupation began to expand again. Then, after the War of Independence in 1948, we gained quite a bit more land. Our occupation and possession of the land had expanded some more. During the Six-Day War of 1967, our possession of the land expanded to approximately 40% of what was promised to us. And that remained pretty consistent through the Yom Kippur War of 1973, the Lebanon War of 1982, Gulf War of 1990. But then came the peace process, and Jewish possession and occupation of the land began to contract again. And this is where the Gaza handover fits in. The Gaza handover, I consider part of the peace process, falls in that area. So a contraction of the land. Now, in the near future, which way will it go? We just don't know. Will we occupy and possess the whole West Bank again? Or will we give up the West Bank and see a contraction? We'll just have to see which way it goes and see how the Lord moves there. But we do know that the tribulation period is coming. And when the tribulation period comes, in the middle of the tribulation, we will be kicked out of the land one more time and be scattered all over the earth. And so our possession and occupation of the land will be minimal again. And then finally, after the tribulation period, comes the institution of the kingdom, the return of Yeshua, the institution of the kingdom, and that is when we will possess 100% of the land promised to us by Abraham, Isaac, and promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's the point of Isaiah 11, 11, and 12. So the modern possession of the land will not occur. Total possession of the land will not occur until the second worldwide regathering. All right, let's look at point E, page 344. Point E, point E is on page 343, excuse me. Point E. While both the Mosaic Covenant and the Land Covenant promise restoration after a worldwide dispersion, the restoration of Israel comes in two stages. Now this you must burn into your mind. The restoration of Israel comes in two stages. The study of the prophets indicates that there will be two worldwide regatherings, and the important word here is worldwide. Worldwide regatherings. Very clearly they're going to be of a greater extent than anything experienced previously. Two worldwide regatherings. Now, the first worldwide regathering, the prophets teach, will be characterized by unbelief. Its purpose will be judgment. It will be experienced, that judgment will be experienced during the tribulation period. And verses such as Ezekiel 20, 33 to 38 teach this doctrine. So that's the first worldwide regathering. The second worldwide regathering will be in faith. Its purpose will be blessing. That blessing will be experienced during the Messianic Kingdom. That's the point of Isaiah 11, verses 11 and 12. Now, this regathering occurs after the tribulation is brought to its conclusion. So the modern state of Israel is the fulfillment of the first of these two worldwide regatherings. The tribulation and the tribulation diaspora will follow. Now, the major mistake that religious Zionism, Jewish religious Zionism, and fervent Christian Zionism make is to misunderstand the purpose of the modern state of Israel. Today is not the day of the final regathering. The Messianic Kingdom is not on the horizon. Full possession of the land is not on the horizon. What is on the horizon? The tribulation is on the horizon, the tribulation period. And realizing that ought to motivate Christians to participate in Jewish missions. We in the Jewish community are heading to tough times. Tough times lay ahead of us. And if you do love Israel and if you do love the Jewish people, you'd want to save Jewish people from the jaws of the tribulation and from the jaws of hell. So I would hope that understanding that the tribulation is on the horizon would burn into your heart and help you to be motivated to participate in Jewish missions. All right, let's look at point F. Point F is on the bottom of page 343. In particular, let's focus in on the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is known in the Bible as the land of the Philistines or the Philistine Plain. Now, Isaiah 11:14 and Obadiah 19 tells us that we will not occupy the Gaza Strip permanently, if at all, until the Messianic Kingdom. Now, both of those verses are found in the context of the kingdom. Now, here is a map of ancient Israel. On the left side, the western side of the map, you see the Philistine Plain. At about its greatest extent here, because the Philistine Plain expanded and contracted depending on the strength and weakness of Israel and Judah. The Gaza Strip is simply this small area of the Philistine Plain today. The Philistine Plain has contracted down quite a bit from its greatest expansion. Now, in the context of the Messianic Kingdom, speaking of Judah and Israel, Isaiah 11:14a states, they, meaning Judah and Israel, will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. So if we look at the Philistine plain, we will see that in the context of setting up the Messianic Kingdom, the Jewish people will swoop down on the Philistine plain and possess it. Now, if we already possess the Gaza Strip prior to the Messianic Kingdom, there'll be no need to swoop down upon it and possess it. But we know that we will be kicked out of the land in the middle of the tribulation period, and so we will not possess the land nor the Philistine plain. So, in fact, I doubt if we will occupy the Gaza Strip at all until the Messianic Kingdom comes. But we'll see what happens there. I really think it's very doubtful, but we'll see as time passes. Okay, that's really some of the major points in the article. You can read the rest of the article on your own. Now let's turn to page 346. Turn to page 346, and about the bottom quarter of the page, you see the heading September 25th, 2005. Hamas announces its intent to halt operations in Gaza. September 27th, Hamas kidnaps and kills a settler on the West Bank. October 20th, Bush orders Abbas to stand up to armed gangs and bring an end to violence. So Mahmoud Abbas is the leader of the Palestinian Authority, and groups like Hamas are wreaking violence upon Israel. So President Bush said, come on, get with it. Let's stop this violence, end the violence. page 347. October 26, 2005. Does Abbas manage to do that? October 26, Palestinian Islamic Jihad suicide bomber kills six in Hadera. Israel responds by ruling out talks with the PA until the violence quells. November 15th, an agreement on movement and access from the Gaza Strip to Israel is reached. An important agreement because the Palestinians do need some access into Israel. November 21st, 2005. Sharon asserts he is no longer willing to deal with Likud rebels. He was the leader of the Likud party, a very conservative party, and he was beginning to move in a different direction. So he resigns from the party and creates a new centrist party, Kadima, not quite as conservative as the Likud. He asks President Katsav to dissolve parliament and schedule an early election. So as you see, at the end of 2005 especially, Israel was undergoing political turmoil, turmoil from terrorists, and now political turmoil within their own government. So outer turmoil, inner turmoil, and attacks. So it's a stressful time in Israel during 2005. An attempt to kidnap an IDF soldier was foiled when paratroopers patrolling near Rajah village discerned a Hezbollah unit approaching. This is Hezbollah from the north. Private David Markowitz opened fire, killing all four. And in a heavy attack of mortars and Katyusha rockets that ensued, nine soldiers and two civilians were injured. So we have this battle with Hezbollah up in the north as well. November 25th, 2005, the Rafah border crossing is reopened. That's from Israel into the Gaza Strip. December 5th, 2005. Palestinian Islamic Jihad kills five in Netanya. Israel retaliates by barring Palestinians from entering Israel for a week. Now, that might seem like a pretty mild retaliation, but many Palestinians had employment in Israel, and so it hit their economic base pretty hard. So it wasn't quite as mild as it seems. December 24, 2005, Christmas time, 2005, 500 Orthodox Jews break into a Messianic service in Beersheba, Israel, and attack the Jewish believers. Messianic congregation in Arad is similarly harassed. And there's a typo there. It's the Messianic congregation in Arad, not if Arad, but the congregation is attacked. So we've seen this before, Beersheba and the Arad congregations being harassed. December 27, 2005. A branch of a Palestinian organization connected with Al-Qaeda fires six Katyushas, damaging a house in Kiryat Shmona and a house in Metula. This is again in the north. In response, the IAF, the Israel Air Force, attacks a training base of the Popular Front south of Beirut. December 28, 2005. Responding to rockets fired from Lebanon to northern Israel, Israeli jets attack a terrorist base south of Beirut. So you see the terrorism continues to the end of 2005. Well, that brings us now to the year 2006, page 348 in your outline. And we'll begin with January 4, 2006. A very important event in the history of Israel. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffers a severe stroke and falls into a coma. So Ariel Sharon now exits the political scene because of this serious illness. Ehud Olmert assumes the role of acting prime minister and the acting chairman of Kadima. January 19, 2006. Palestinian Islamic Jihad suicide bombing in Tel Aviv wounds 30. The violence has not been stopped by Mahmoud Abbas, has it? January 25, 2006. Hamas wins a majority in the Palestinian Authority general elections. So the majority of the Palestinians want this terrorist organization to be in the government. The U.S., Israel and several European countries cut off aid to the Palestinians as the Islamic movement rejects Israel's right to exist. Hamas has never recognized Israel's right to exist. The Quartet, January 30th, 2006, the Quartet calls on Hamas to renounce violence and to recognize Israel's right to exist and accept all prior agreements. Do you think they do that? Well, February 21st, 2006, Ismail Haniyeh is sworn in as the Palestinian Prime Minister. He is the leader of Hamas, and he is now the leader of the Palestinian Prime Minister. March 28, 2006, the Kadima Party wins Israeli elections and Ehud Olmert becomes Prime Minister. The voter turnout is the lowest ever at 63.2%. So here is Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, the current Prime Minister, in 2006, the current Prime Minister of Israel. March 30th, 2006, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claims responsibility for a suicide bombing in the West Bank, killing four. Hamas reacts by applauding their efforts. So here is the major part of the Palestinian government applauding attacks upon Israel. That's a great peace partner, isn't it? March 31st, 2006. In an interview with the British press, Hamas head Ismail Haniyeh calls for an end of requests to recognize Israel's right to exist. He gets tired of it. Don't ask me anymore to change my position. I do not recognize Israel's right to exist, never will. Again, great peace partner. April 9th, 2006. The Israeli Security Cabinet recommends severing ties with the Palestinian Authority. Do you blame them with a government like that? Dealing with a government like that, a government that wants the destruction of your country? April 17th, 2006. Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad suicide bombing in Tel Aviv kills 11. Hamas applauds the effort. Fatah denounces it. Of course, Hamas is the dominant party in the Palestinian Authority at this point of time. Fatah is the second most important party. Fatah is headed by Mahmoud Abbas. So we see that there's disagreement to a certain extent within the Palestinian Authority. April 26, 2006. Abbas calls for an international peace conference. May 4, 2006, the new Israeli government takes office. It vows to shape the permanent borders of the State of Israel as a democratic Jewish state with a Jewish majority. That's the philosophy and aim. May 10, 2006, imprison Hamas, Fatah, and other officials draft a national accord document calling for a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital, a right of return for all refugees, and a release of all prisoners. Abbas accepts the document. Hamas rejects the document because of its implied recognition of Israel. So Hamas sees even an implication that Israel should exist, and that raises the hackles on the back of their neck. May 21st, 2006. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni meets Abbas at the World Economic Forum in Egypt. Now here's an important statement as well. Mark this statement. Abbas asserts that permanent arrangements are impossible without resolving the main issues, and that's the key why this is important. The main issues of the conflict in 2006, security, borders, Jerusalem, refugees. Security against terrorism. What will the final states look like? What will their borders look like? Will Jerusalem be divided? Will the refugees be allowed to return? Abbas also claims that Israeli unilateralism will increase violence and put an end to the two-state solution. Haniyeh says his government will maintain a ceasefire for many years if Israel withdraws to the 1967 borders. Now, isn't that generous of Hamas? We will maintain a ceasefire for many years. Notice, he doesn't say we will enter into a permanent ceasefire, nor does he say we're willing to enter it into a permanent peace treaty. But you give us what you want. Give us what we want. You give us what we want, and we won't shoot at you for a few years. Isn't that a great deal? Really sounds like a great bargain to me. But that's who Israel is dealing with. May 23, 2006, Olmert meets President Bush in the White House. Bush and Olmert reiterate their commitment to a two-state solution. May 27, 2006, an IDF soldier is wounded when Katyusha are fired at an army base at Mount Merom in the Upper Galilee. Again, harassment from the north. May 28, 2006, Palestinian rockets hit deep into northern Israel. Israel responds by striking terrorist bases in Lebanon. So the northern border is hot. June 10, 2006, Hamas ends a 16-month-long truce as cross-border violence escalates near Gaza. June 25, 2006, Hamas, popular resistance committees, and Army of Islam militants attack Israeli forces in Israel, killing two Israeli soldiers, wounding four, and kidnapping Corporal Gilad Shalit. And this is a photograph of this young man, Corporal Shalit, taken prisoner by the Islamic militants in the Gaza Strip. He will remain a prisoner for quite a number of years. The terrorists had reached Israel through a tunnel from Gaza and demanded the release of an estimated 400 prisoners, mostly women and minors. June 27, 2006, after diplomatic efforts to secure the release of kidnapped soldier were unsuccessful, the IDF begins a major operation in Gaza to rescue Shalit, to deter future Hamas attacks and weaken the Hamas government. It's known as Operation Summer Rains. It was followed by Operation Autumn Clouds, and both were totally unsuccessful in freeing Shalit, in deterring attacks, or weakening the Hamas government. June 28, 2006. Palestinian factions agree on a revised National Accord document. This is that prisoners document, which states that the PLO and the president of the PA will be responsible for negotiations with Israel to create a state on territories occupied by Israel in 1967. In other words, Israel needs to retreat to the 1967 borders. The popular resistance committees announced that they kidnapped a young West Bank settler and would kill him if Israel did not stop the Gaza operation. Three alleged perpetrators of this attack were arrested on July 4th in Ramallah. Israeli jets fly over Syrian President Bashar Assad's summer residence in Latakia as a warning to stop supporting terrorism. In other words, we can get you if we want to. All right, June 29, 2006, the end of June. The kidnapped West Bank settler's body is found. Israeli forces arrest 64 Hamas cabinet ministers, parliamentarians, and other officials in the West Bank and Jerusalem. All right, I think we're about time now for your break. So let's go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up after the break with July. We're now halfway through the year of 2006. All right, let's pick it up where we left off. We are at July 2nd, 2006. That's the top of page 351. Page 351 in your notebook, halfway through the year 2006. All right, July 2nd. A Hamas rocket hits Israeli port city of Ashkelon, hitting near a vacant school. This is the furthest north a Palestinian rocket has ever struck. So the range of the Hamas rockets is getting longer and longer. The Israeli government approved prolonged activities against Hamas, institutions and infrastructures used by terrorist organizations, and rocket launching squads in Gaza. Israeli operations in Gaza were expanded. July 12, 2006, the Second Lebanon War. Hezbollah kidnaps two Israeli soldiers, Ehud Goldwasser and Eldad Ragav, Al-Regev, and kills three Israeli soldiers in Israeli territory, sparking the Second Lebanon War, July 12th. Hezbollah demands the release of three Lebanese and other Arab prisoners in exchange for the return of Goldwasser, Regev, and Shalit. Prime Minister Olmert declares Hezbollah's attack as an act of war. So the 2006 Lebanon war commences. It began as a military operations in response to the abduction of two Israeli reserve soldiers by the Hezbollah. The operation gradually strengthened to become a wider confrontation. The principal participants were Hezbollah, paramilitary forces, and the Israeli military. The conflict started on July 12, 2006, continued until a United Nations brokered ceasefire went into effect the 14th of August, 2006. Although it formally ended the 8th of September, 2006, when Israel lifted its naval blockade of Lebanon. The war resulted in the pacification of southern Lebanon and in the weakness of the Hezbollah, which suffered serious casualties but managed to survive the Israeli onslaught. July 16, 2006. The G8 blames Hezbollah and Hamas for the destabilization of the region, and he calls upon them to halt their attacks. G8 also calls upon Israel to, quote, be mindful of the strategic and humanitarian consequences of their actions. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and several Gulf states blame Hezbollah for the war. Now there's a switch. So at least the right person is finally being fingered. All right, July 17th. We are now on page 352 at the top of the page. July 17th, 2006. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert issues calls on Hezbollah to return the kidnapped soldiers, to cease terrorist attacks, and to allow Lebanese troops to deploy along the border. August 8, 2006. The Lebanese government offers to deploy 15,000 troops to the Israel-Lebanon border in exchange for a complete Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. August 11, 2006. The United Nations Security Council passes Resolution 1701, calling for an end of hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah. August 14th, Israel and Hezbollah agree to the United Nations ceasefire. The Lebanese defense minister declares that Lebanon has no intention of disarming Hezbollah. And this is required by the UN Security Council Resolution 1701. But there's not much cooperation coming from the Lebanese government or from Hezbollah. August 9, 2006, Israeli forces raid Hezbollah's stronghold in southern Lebanon after continued Hezbollah violations of the ceasefire agreement. Now here's a map of the Israeli bombings of Lebanon. And you can see that the vast majority of the attention is focused on southern Lebanon where Hezbollah is located. Lots of violations, lots of need to attack the Hezbollah organization in Lebanon. It's not exactly curbed by the Lebanese government. Now, August 25th, 2006. We are now at the top of page 353. Very important announcement, very important event. Iran is developing nuclear weapons capability. Israel starts preparing for a possible conflict. So once this comes on the table, there's a big change in the whole outlook of the Middle East. Now here is a map of Iranian nuclear resources. These people are very, very capable of developing a large nuclear weapons capability. For example, here is the diagrams are of nuclear reactors in operation at Bushehr and one under construction at Darkovir. So they have nuclear reactors. They say for producing power. These green symbols are research reactors. And they've established three research reactors, Tehran and Natanz and Iraq. So they are definitely increasing their capability in the nuclear field. These red columns our sites for enriching uranium, one in Fordo, one in Natanz. This yellow symbol symbolizes where yellow cake is stored. Yellow cake is enriched uranium, Ardakan. So enriched uranium is stored here. And then the Iranians even have two uranium mines, one uranium mine at Jishin and another one at Sarkhand. So two uranium mines. So they have a lot of resources. This is a very, very serious announcement, a very, very serious movement on the part of Iran, because they are quite capable of carrying it out. September 21st, 2006, Abbas informs the United Nations General Assembly that all future Palestinian governments will comply with previously signed agreements. Wow, that's a big statement. Words are cheap, however. September 30th, 2006, the last Israeli soldier withdraws from Lebanon. October 31st to November 8th, middle of page 353. Israeli forces enter the northern Gaza town of Beit Hanun in an effort to prevent rocket fire into Israel. This is Gaza again. The government appoints a commission of inquiry chaired by retired Judge Eliyahu Weinograd to investigate and draw lessons from the war in Lebanon. November 13. Prime Minister Olmert meets with President Bush. Following talks between Hamas and Fatah, both sides agree to form a unity government, the Palestinians being governed by Hamas and Fatah. November 25th, Palestinians and Israelis agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. November 27th, 2006, Olmert expresses willingness to implement the roadmap and urges the Palestinians to uphold the principles outlined by the quartet, because they haven't been doing it. November 28th, United States National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley reiterates Olmert's point that an agreement between Israel and Syria cannot be reached until Syria stops supporting terrorism. Again, that is in the north. December 6, 2006, Iraq Study Group's report is released. Remember that we talked about that just a few minutes ago. Making a recommendation that Israel transfer the entire Golan Heights to Syria to help stabilize the region. You think that would stabilize the region? Syria, on the high ground right over the nation of Israel. It wasn't very stable when Syria occupied that area in the past. Israel, of course, did not accept this recommendation. December 8, 2006, Hamas head Ismail Haniyeh travels to Iran and publicly declares that Hamas will never recognize Israel's right to exist. There you go. They say it over and over and over again. December 16th, Abbas calls for new elections as a solution to the ongoing crisis in the Palestinian government. December 23rd, Olmert promises to give the Palestinian Authority $100 million in tax revenue for humanitarian purposes. You think they use it for humanitarian purposes? If you believe that, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. All right. We now enter 2007, page 354, January 14th, 2007. Abbas rejects Olmert's offer at establishing preliminary borders for a future Palestinian state out of fear that such borders would become permanent. Notice the hypocrisy in Mahmoud Abbas. He is such a hypocrite. First, he demands borders. That's a key issue. We need to decide on the borders. And then he rejects the proposals for borders. Oh, but we don't want them to become permanent, that's for sure. So I don't want to discuss borders. I don't even want to discuss preliminary borders. But I want borders. So what can you do with that? January 17, 2007, Chief of Staff Dan Halutz and Defense Minister Amir Peretz resign following criticism of their role in the Lebanon War. But Olmert holds on to his office. So here is a photograph of Chief of Staff Dan Chalutz. He resigned. And also, this was the current Defense Minister Amir Peretz. They did not hold on to their positions due to the Lebanon War. All right, January 29, 2007. Palestinian Islamic Jihad claims responsibility for a suicide bombing in Eilat, which killed three Israelis. Eilat is the very southern town, the most southern town in Israel. So terrorism has not been stopped at all. January 30th, 2007. Fatah and Hamas reach a ceasefire agreement mediated by Egypt after a series of clashes that led to the death of 32 Palestinians. Both sides welcome a Saudi initiative to meet in Mecca. So Fatah and Hamas are at odds with each other, basically because Hamas wants total control. Well, they both want total control. Page 355, February 2nd, 2007. The quartet calls on the PA unity government to revert to its commitments as outlined in the roadmap. In other words, follow through on your commitments. So this Palestinian unity government is not following the roadmap as they agreed to do so. February 8th, here comes that Palestinian unity agreement in Mecca. They met in Mecca. They came up with an agreement. They decided that Hamas and Fatah would agree to share power based on a very vaguely worded statement. But Hamas officials reiterate that they will never recognize Israel. They are very consistent in that position, aren't they? We will never recognize Israel. The U.S. and Israel, in contrast, insist that the new government must recognize the right of Israel to exist. They must disarm terrorist groups. And they must agree to end the violence. You think Hamas is going to do that? The destruction of Israel, the arming of terrorist groups, and violence are the foundation of the Hamas government's style. All right, let's move to February 9th. The quartet welcomes the role of Saudi Arabia in reaching the agreement to form a Palestinian National Union government, but reaffirms that it must obey international demands to recognize Israel, renounce violence, and abide by previous peace agreements. So we're glad you guys are getting along. Let's just do something in the practical. Let's do something that will bring peace. Well, of course, that never happens. February 15th, 2007. Ismail Haniyeh, just a few days later, Ismail Haniyeh and his cabinet resign from the unity government, because they don't want to follow through on those kind of commitments. What happens? Haniyeh is reappointed by Abbas. And so they begin the process of forming a new Palestinian unity government. So it didn't last very long, just a few days. So they're at it again. February 19th, Secretary Rice meets with Olmert and Abbas in Jerusalem to discuss the Mecca Accord, to discuss this unity government. March 15th. A Palestinian unity government is formed again. The Arab League, March 28th and 29th, the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia reiterates adherence without changes to the Arab Peace Initiative and to direct negotiations on all tracks. April 30th, the Inquiry Commission into the military campaign held in Lebanon in summer of 2006, headed by former Justice Dr. Eliyahu Vinograd, submitted to the Prime Minister and Minister of Defense an interim report relating to the time from the IDF's exit from Lebanon to the soldiers' abduction on July 12, 2006, and to the time between July 12th and July 17th, when the decision to move into war was taken. Page 356, June 13th, 2007. The Knesset elected Shimon Peres to serve as the ninth president of Israel after Moshe Katsav resigned amid impending charges of sexual harassment of female subordinates. And here is Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres has been active in all levels of the Israeli government all his life, I think, and he's a very, very key player in the history of the modern state of Israel. So here he now, here on June 13th, 2007, he becomes the president of Israel, which is basically a symbolic office, but still one with a lot of visibility. June 15th, 2007. Hamas forces attack Fatah in the Gaza. So the Hamas forces are attacking the forces of the other party in government. Remember, this is Hamas, Fatah, unity government, and now the Hamas forces attack the Fatah supporters in Gaza, and they drive them out of the Gaza Strip in brutal attacks. The response? President Mahmoud Abbas dissolves the unity government, but Prime Minister Haniyeh insists that the government is still in power. A summit in Sharm el-Sheikh attended by Egypt, Jordan, and Palestinians pledges support to the Abbas government, but Egypt calls for reunification with Hamas. So the unity government that was put together in March 15th has now fallen apart in June 15th by reason of this armed coup by Hamas to get rid of Fatah. June 17, 2007. President Abbas forms a new Palestinian emergency cabinet to replace the unity government, which he dissolved after Hamas took control of the Gaza Strip. Hamas selected Salam Fayyad as the new Palestinian prime minister. And here is a photograph of Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad. And he is still very active in Palestinian politics today. So he became the new prime minister. June 18, 2007. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak is sworn in as Israel's defense minister. Barak received a vote of approval from Parliament to replace Amir Peretz, who lost to Barak in last week's Labour Party leadership election. The U.S. lifts its embargo on the Palestinian government in an effort to boost the strength of President Abbas and his Fatah's party's struggle against Hamas, because Abbas is a tiny little bit more liberal than Hamas. The United States is trying to support them. June 19, 2007. Prime Minister Olmert and President Bush meet in Washington to discuss the situation in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So Olmert and President Bush had a pretty close relationship, talking to each other very often. June 24, 2007. Israel transfers hundreds of millions of dollars to Abbas's emergency government in the West Bank. Again, trying to prop up the less radical of the two ingredients of the Palestinian government. Page 357, June 25, 2007. Olmert, Abbas, Egyptian President Mubarak, and Jordanian King Abdullah II meet in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Same day, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem calls on Hamas to release Galid Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was kidnapped 1 year ago today. So Galid Shalit has been in captivity now for one entire year. The next day, June 26th, Olmert, Abbas, and special envoys from the European Union, Russia, the United Nations, and the United States meet today in Jerusalem at the U.S. consulate. The quartet, Russia, the United States, the European Union, and the United Nations, names Tony Blair as the new Mideast envoy. So here's Tony Blair from England. So he is now involved in the peace process, and I think he's still involved pretty much down to today. All right, let's go to July 1st, 2007. We're on page 357, July 1st. Olmert transfers $118 million to the Palestinian Authority. So don't tell me that Israel is an apartheid government. Here they're trying to support the less radical of their Islamic Palestinian counterparts, to the tune of $118 million. July 15, 2007. Here we have another important moment. Mark it up. July 15th. Put a highlight along that. This is important biblically, very important biblically. Israeli priests hold the first gathering since the temple era. Jews belonging to the tribe of Levi, and particularly the Cohen clan, came together for a mass gathering in Jerusalem on Sunday. It was the first large-scale gathering of biblically mandated Israelite priests since the time of the Second Temple. The gathering included lectures and seminars on the history and future of the temple, and culminated with all the participants declaring the priestly blessing over Israel from the Western Wall. Genetic research over the past several decades have succeeded in isolating a particular DNA signature shared by all members of the tribe of Levi. Isn't that amazing? This DNA signature is available when Israel's back in the land and members of the tribe of Levi can be positively identified. It's a signature shared by all members of the tribe of Levi, making the reinstitution of Israel's priestly caste a relatively simple endeavor once the temple is rebuilt. I think that's amazing. That's God's timing. And the pressure to build the temple continues unabated. For example, if you go to the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, you will tour that building and you'll see a lot of items on display. For example, you'll see the high priest's garments and an incense altar on display. Well, folks, these are not museum pieces. The Temple Institute fully intends to use all that's on display in the temple when it gets rebuilt. They fully intend the high priest to wear these garments that are in this glass display case. They fully intend for the priest to burn incense on that gold incense altar. So it's a great place to visit as you see the foundations, the preparations for the temple, I should say, are underway. So garments have been made by the Temple Institute. Also, by the way, this is their website, off their website, is the musical instruments for use in the temple have been made. Here's a nevel, a harp. So the musical instruments have been made. The instruments for conducting the sacrificial service have been constructed. This is a small mitzrach. A mitzrach is the small bowl that catches the blood from the sacrifice. So the sacrificial instruments have been constructed. Again, they fully intend to use these. These are not display pieces. They are to be used in the temple. The furniture for the holy place has been constructed. Not only the incense altar, but here is the golden table of showbread. And if you're interested in the work of the Temple Institute and their work to prepare for the coming temple, a good book to buy is The Holy Temple in Jerusalem by Chaim Richman. You can get it on Amazon.com. You've seen a lot of pictures of the implements that have been constructed by the Holy Temple in my PowerPoint shows. That's because I've purchased this book, and many of the photographs in the book I have scanned in for use in my PowerPoint shows. So The Holy Temple in Jerusalem is a great book to buy. Another one is Carta's Illustrated Encyclopedia of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. I have this work as well. It is co-authored by Israel Ariel and Chaim Richman. And again, rich in information about the temple and rich in drawings and photographs of, all about the temple operation. So if you're interested in this subject, I would recommend these two resources for you very, very highly. And there's more. There's much more as well. If you go to Israel, stop into a good bookstore at one of the gift shops, and you'll see a good number of additional books about the temple. So keep that in mind next time you go to Israel. All right, let's see. We've got about 5 minutes here. So let's continue on through July, see if we can get July finished up. July 16th, 2007, bottom of page 357. President Bush calls for a Middle East peace conference in the fall to be led by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and to include Palestinians, Israelis, and regional neighbors who support creation of a Palestinian state, as well as new aid measures to support the West Bank-based government of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salim Fayyad, because they are willing to state they are interested in a two-state solution. They are being supported. Hamas, of course, states that they will never accept the state of Israel, and so they're not being supported by these governments. They are off in the Gaza Strip, radicalizing it. All right, let's turn to page 358. July 20th, 2007. Israel releases 256 prisoners, grants clemency to 178 members of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and scales back its troop operations aimed at other militants in the West Bank. So here, Israel is setting a positive atmosphere for these for this Middle East peace conference that Condoleezza Rice is going to lead. And Israel time and time and time again has attempted to set a positive atmosphere by releasing prisoners and transferring money. But all to no avail. July 25th, the Arab League sends its first formal delegation to Israel to officially present the Arab League peace offer that would see full recognition of Israel in exchange for withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the creation of a Palestinian state. The deal was first offered back in 2002. Of course, it got nowhere, but now it is offered again. On July 27th, 2 days later, Palestinian Prime Minister Fayyad presents his government's program. It seeks to establish a Palestinian state on all lands occupied by Israel in 1967 with Jerusalem as its capital, and a just solution for Palestinian refugees. That's his position. I see I've got a couple of more minutes. Let's see if we can get to 2008. August 6, 2007. Olmert and Abbas meet in a pre-conference discussions. September 6, 2007. Operation Orchard. Operation Orchard was an Israeli airstrike on a nuclear reactor in the Deir el-Zor region of Syria, carried out just after midnight on September 6, 2007. The White House and Central Intelligence Agency later confirmed that American intelligence had also indicated the site was a nuclear facility with a military purpose, though Syria denies this. According to news reports, the raid was carried out by Israeli Air Force Squadron 69. They were using F-51Is, F-16Is, and an El-Nit aircraft. As many as 8 aircraft participated in at least 4, and at least 4 of these crossed into Syrian airspace. The fighters were equipped with AGM-65 Maverick missiles, 500-pound bombs, and external fuel tanks. One report stated that a team of elite Israeli Shaldag Special Forces commandos arrived at the site the day before so they could highlight the target with laser designators, while a later report identified Sayeret Matkal Special Forces commandos as involved. Well, here is a map of how Operation Orchard proceeded on the night of September 5 and 6. Here in the upper right-hand corner, in the red circle, you can see a map. The F-15I fighters of the 69th Squadron left Israel, flew out over the Mediterranean, then turned to the east over Lebanon and into Syria. Now, the picture shows them attacking the Al-Kibar complex in the, it's kind of a 3D map, and in a valley there is that suspicious complex. And here is the before and after pictures of the attack. Before, on the left side, you can see this rectangular building in the middle of the complex. But afterwards, you see that the building has been destroyed and the Syrians have bulldozed the area smooth. Nothing left of that nuclear complex anymore. So it was quite a successful operation. October 9th, 2007. Syria refuses to attend after Israel declines to put the issue of the Golan Heights as a topic of discussion at the upcoming conference. November 6, 2007. The conference is set for the last week of November. It's expected to produce a joint declaration to pave the way for negotiations on core issues, including Jerusalem and the refugees. So there were very high expectations for this conference. November 12th. The United States promises Syria that the issue of the Golan Heights will be brought up on the agenda of the upcoming regional peace conference. November 27, 2007, we have the Annapolis Conference. The Annapolis Conference was a Middle East peace conference held on the 27th of November, 2007 at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, United States. The conference aimed to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and implement the roadmap for peace. The conference ended with the issue of a joint statement from all parties. After the Annapolis conference, the negotiations were continued. A joint understanding read by U.S. President George Bush stated that, quote, in furtherance of the goal of the two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace and security, unquote, the parties agreed to, quote, immediately launch good faith bilateral negotiations in order to conclude a peace treaty, resolve all outstanding issues, including all core issues without exception, as specified in previous agreements. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounded great. The steering committee would meet from 12th of December 2007, followed by a biweekly negotiations between President Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert. Oh, wait, page 360. The parties also committed to immediately implementing their respective obligations under the roadmap for peace and to continue the implementations of it until they reached a peace agreement to be concluded by the end of 2008. And here's a photograph of President Bush in the center, Ehud Olmert on the left, and Abbas on the right. There was high hopes for a peace agreement at this time between Israel and the Palestinians. December 12, 2007, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators begin formal talks to launch the U.S.-brokered peace process initiated at the Annapolis Conference. And that brings us to 2008 on page 360, so we'll quit right there. I've kept you a couple minutes over. We'll pick it up next time at page 360 and the year 2008. We'll see you then.